Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is November 6, 2025, and this is episode 560. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York, the Great Awakening region, I should add. I'm going to talk about that sometime in the future. This is actually where Joseph Smith got his Mormon thing going, in this general area. That's for another time. Anyway, you're listening to Radio Warnerd. Please subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd and join the Warnerd Legion. I have with me today the co-host of American Prestige, the American Prestige podcast, and also the man behind the Foreign Exchanges Substack and podcast. Derek Davison. Derek, first of all, thanks for coming on the show, and also congratulations on winning that big podcast
award. Our major award. Yeah, it's like a Christmas story. We're going to get a lamp of a lady's leg to put in the window. But thank you. Yes, we won the Signal Awards.
Signal Awards.
And you, listener's choice. We got a silver. Like they do category awards like that are judged, and we got a silver, and I was like, oh wow, we got the silver in a category, but there were like three gold winners and three silver winners. Like it kind of
everybody's
took the luster
a winner.
Off of it. Yeah, everybody's a winner basically. So you know, I mean, that was something, but we did win the listener voting part of
that's
it.
That's great.
So that was fun.
I put in my vote for you guys too. So.
Thank
you. I want to say I put you over the edge, but we'll see.
Oh, well, I don't know. I didn't see a count. It might have been a single vote.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say again, because we're always keeping tabs on my co-host, John Dolan, who is, he's expected, so today's Thursday, I think he's expected to go home on Saturday. I just had a communication, his email back and forth with his wife, Catherine. And he's doing better and still improving. But like I said, we want to let him take off November. So we're really happy that Derek is here. I should add.
I just want to say, like, best wishes to him, obviously.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
For his recovery. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, it does suck. And I know John don't like hospitals. I mean, John don't like going to the dentist or seeing, you know, who does, but he really doesn't. So I know how extra miserable this is for John. But that said, he was a bit cheered up by the news about Dick Cheney. That kind of cheered him up in his hospital.
There
bit.
You go.
So, Derek, and I should tell people too, Derek and I and Daniel Bessner, your co-host, we've been talking about doing a crossover. And we shall do a crossover, but the things keep getting in the way, mostly on our end. Surgeries, falls, hospital stays, vacations, etc. But when
life,
we shall do it.
Yeah.
Life, yeah, but we shall do it. And the reason I asked Derek to come on, and he's so generously agreed, is really to try to talk about Trump's global vision. Trump's foreign policy in the world is quite hot. I think a lot hotter than when Trump took office in 2017. And if there's a vision, you know, that we can see, that we can make out, like what we can say about Trump's, you know, Trump versus the world, and what his vision is, and who his lieutenants are, and how it's going. I mean, according to Trump, of course, he's stopped at least a dozen wars. Derek, I don't know where we should start today. I mean, maybe we should just briefly mention the RSF, the genocidal Sudanese paramilitary backed by one of Trump's friendly countries in the Gulf, the UAE, just announced that it agreed to a humanitarian ceasefire in Sudan. This is after taking Fashir. And I'm sure Trump's going to take full credit for this if it happens. But what can you tell us about the RSF?
Yeah, Trump? not much yet. But this is, I mean, he could theoretically take credit for this. This is apparently the U.S. ceasefire proposal. I don't know if it's the same one that the military government rejected earlier this week, but they looked at something that the U.S. gave them. And this is, you know, under the aegis of the so-called Quad, the fine group of countries that are trying to mediate this conflict, Egypt and the UAE, two countries that might as well be combatants at this point.
Right.
And Saudi Arabia. Like they submitted something to the government that got rejected. And they were like, no, we're going to keep fighting. Thank you very much. And then the RSF just on a Thursday, I think, said, yeah, we're fully on board with this ceasefire thing. And I think like they're trying to, my guess is they're trying to curry favor with Trump. Like they're trying to make the military government look like the bad guys here. Mm. Despite the fact, or because of the fact that they are in the process of carrying out genocidal acts in Darfur, that, you know, this is some effort to deflect from that. So they're happy to agree to a ceasefire that probably isn't going to happen, I guess, because the government, the military has said no. And even if it does happen, I mean, they just had a pretty major victory in Al-Fashir, taking that city, and they can consolidate almost all of Darfur at this point under their control. It's not a bad time for them to pause anyway, I guess. So it's sort of a no-lose for them. Like if the ceasefire actually happens, then they get to sit on the what they just conquered. If it doesn't, they at least get to say, you know, look, we're the reasonable party here. Like we're the ones who want to pause. It's these other guys. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but there is definitely a new like PR push coming out of, I think, the UAE lately to emphasize the fact that there's Muslim Brotherhood elements that are fighting with alongside the military and try to paint the RSF again in the midst of carrying out what has been, you know, credibly described as genocidal acts in Darfur, in the middle of this, to portray them as the good guys because they're the secularists. And, you know, you have these awful Muslim Brotherhood people fighting with the military. Not that the military is any better, you know, in the big scheme of things. But it's just interesting. It's been interesting to watch online this, like, very concerted effort by some right-wing folks in the U.S. and just various Twitter accounts to push this narrative and to insist that it's actually the Muslim Brotherhood carrying out the genocide, which is, you know, completely fictional at this point, but you know, definitely like trying to spin things in a certain direction.
I've noticed it, that sort of in line with this, that first of all, a lot of accounts that are usually very pro-Israel and very anti-Palestine have been pushing this, but that they got the messaging, a lot of them got the messaging wrong. They would say, you see what's happening in Darfur, the RSF are Islamists, and this is what Islamists,
like they got the message wrong. The parties, yeah.
No, it's supposed to be like, the SAF, no. You idiot.
You cease and desist. You get like the guy on the, you know, the aircraft controller guy with the the orange wands, like wave off. there's been some of that. I have seen that. That's funny. It definitely, you're right though. I mean, there's definitely a connection between the people who have been denying that there's a genocide in Gaza and the people who are now like, the same people who have for 2 years been saying, why aren't you talking about Sudan, while they themselves have no fucking idea what's happening in Sudan and just are using it as a cudgel. Now they know like a tiny fragment of information from Sudan and they keep fucking it up in their presentation.
There was that kind of famous quote, and I know you guys have talked about what's going on in Sudan since the war broke out. We've done a few episodes, and there was that famous or infamous line, I think it came out through one of the major paper articles on it, where, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going by my faulty memory here, but somebody from the Biden administration essentially said, when asked about the war as it was getting more and more genocidal, look, the only issue here is keeping the UAE in the Abraham. The UAE is in the Abraham Accords and friendly with Israel, and that is our only interest in the Sudan war. So that was the Biden administration. Is there a similar quote unquote vision going on here guiding Trump, or is it even less than that?
I mean, I think it's probably less than that. He just likes the UAE. Like, these are just his peeps, you know, like the Arab Gulf monarchies. That's like his thing. Like, he loves being in that environment around those people. They give him expensive presents, like, yes, you know, $400 million planes. Orbs that he can touch. These are exactly the kind of people that he spent his entire life sucking up to.
Right.
And, you know, I think he just feels at home with them. For the people around him, I'm sure that the main consideration, I mean, to the extent that they're thinking about this in terms of a bigger policy, like keeping the UAE happy as the vehicle for normalization, like leading the push to normalize with Israel, for maintaining, you know, muscular secularism in that part of the world, or at least a vision of it. I think you know, it serves a number of purposes aside from just, you know, pleasing Donald Trump. But for him, I think it's pure, like, these are my guys.
Right. Well, this brings us then to the kind of the overarching question I wanted to ask you from your vantage point in Northern Virginia. And by the way, congratulations on your new governor from Langley.
We are so happy.
Democracy's safe, right? So it's either MAGA or the CIA. That's your choice.
Oh my God. Yeah. I know.
So what have you been able to see? I mean, you know, we know that so much about Trump is, and his vision and politics are about Trump. But there's more to it as well, I would imagine. He certainly has drawn people with a more fleshed out vision that seems to align with his own vision on the campaign trail and so on. But how would you describe it? And then we can start talking about a few of the people who are key in that world.
Yeah, I mean, I think his vision is basically that I should be allowed to do whatever I want. I mean, it's just, this is the same as his vision for domestic policy. Like, there should be no checks on me. I'm the president and I'm Donald Trump and I do what I want and, you know, screw everybody else. I think he's got that vision in foreign policy, but he's aware enough to understand that you can't do that and not, you know, sort of allow the other big boys at the table to do what they want. So he's got a certain, although, you know, Ukraine has been a mess through this entire few months, but he's back and forth all the time on that. But I think he's on some base level thinks that Putin's argument that this is his turf and you know, he should be allowed to do what he wants with it, that he that resonates with him. Even in Asia, despite the, you know, kind of new Cold War, trade war stuff, I think he feels like, you know, that's China's backyard to some degree. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't want anything to happen that would embarrass him or embarrass the U.S. But what I think that means, like this, it's sort of a sphere of influence thing, but not nearly as cohesive or fleshed out as an actual concept of spheres of influence and how that would work geopolitically. It's just sort of a sense that, like, the big boys should get to bully everybody else. Mm-hmm. And where that comes down hardest is on Latin America. And I think that's what you're seeing with, like, you know, the Venezuela stuff, the boat, the war on speedboats, whatever it is. You know, now they're talking about bombing Colombia too. And, like, you know, Mexico is this playground apparently for special forces, and the whole, like, you know, counter narcotics fig leaf that they've thrown over it. But I really feel like we're going to see increasingly over the rest of this term, he's going to come down hard on Latin America, because that's where, like, that's the backyard. That's the place where he feels like the U.S. should be free to you know, rampage right at will.
That's where he meets the least resistance from a few of the other big boys.
Right, and that's, yeah, right, exactly. That's where he's going to get, you know, the least pushback from any of the other major countries.
So I assume you saw that article, rather chilling article in the New York Times, which kind of coldly laid out the war possibilities and potential sort of Trump war plans against Venezuela. I mean, it gave me such 2002 vibes.
It's wild. I mean, yeah. Like they're already, they haven't even started really. They haven't started bombing Venezuela and they're already expanding the target list. Like they've already got targets in Colombia and Mexico, like, yeah. You know, that they're putting together these lists. And again, that's to maintain, I think, the fiction that this is somehow about drugs. Because there aren't any good drug targets in Venezuela, despite the fact, like, you know, that supposedly all of our drugs now are coming through Venezuela. Like fentanyl is you know, flooding America from Venezuela somehow, which is just completely false.
Yeah.
But they can't, you know, they're struggling to find legitimate, like, drug-related targets in Venezuela. So they're like, well, we got these other countries we don't like. Why don't we bomb them too? Because there's more drug sites there. But yeah, it's the war on terror, like super speed run. Like it's growing before it even gets started. It's like getting into this massive, you know, expansion, which is really, that's going to be fun. Yeah.
Without all the whole, the long sort of buildup that at least W gave us, you know, a lot of lies first, a year of scaring the shit out of everybody. Like they haven't bothered scaring the shit out of us. It's just, this is what we're going to do, as you said, because we can. And it's very strange. I mean, isn't the reason that this looks like a kind of, you know, war on drugs on drugs and war on terror on drugs and steroids. Like,
it's the war on narco terror. Let's get it right.
Okay. War on narco terror on drugs. Okay. On steroids. But I mean, it's because of the legal rationales, the way that the empire has kind of, constructed itself, that you need these emergency rationales in order to take all kinds of executive action. And we like to pretend that there are checks and balances. Maybe there still are. I'm extremely skeptical of that. But I know that, you know, certainly since World War II and then in a big way again when Reagan reconstructed it, and then, of course, since the GWAT, like they've used war on drugs as the first emergency and war on terror, I guess, probably roughly at the same time, which went big in 2001, to justify war anywhere, pretty much.
Or just to justify killing people. I mean, the boat bombing is like,
it's incredible.
You know, they're telling people in Congress that they don't know who they're bombing and they don't know what their affiliation is if they have one, and they don't, you know, they repatriated those two survivors of that one bombing because they said this to people in Congress, like we don't have the evidence to put them on trial.
Right.
But they're killing them. Like they're killing people. Like just summarily executing people on less evidence than you would need to bring them to trial. That is a stunning thing to say out loud to somebody. And it lends itself to the idea that eventually, I mean, and really this is the conclusion of the war on, like this is where we've been heading for decades. You're just going to get to the point where the president points at somebody and says, you know, blow that person up. Take him out, and they'll do it. And you ask whether there's checks or balances. It's sort of weird to me that we haven't already gotten to the point where the president can just say, you know what, bomb Caracas. I don't have a reason. Like I don't have a justification. I just feel like it. I just feel like blowing the shit out of the city, and the military will go do it. But they still, it's surprising to me we haven't gotten to that point, but they still feel the need to operate in this figmentary universe of like legal justifications or manufacturing these terms that even when nobody agrees with, like, you know, you get international lawyers, people in the State Department, ex-officials who are like, this is, you can't just blow up a boat because you feel like it. And that's what they're doing. But they still, you know, it's so it's not winning anybody. Like, it's not selling anybody on anything. I don't know if it's for the professionalized military that these guys need to feel like the generals need something to cling to say that this is still like a legal rationale somehow. That's the only thing I can think of as a reason for maintaining this fiction instead of just getting to the point where you just, you know, wake up and here's your target today.
Right. Well, let's expand a little bit on this, and you know the so-called vision. Who are the people running Venezuela foreign policy? Who are the people who are saying a good idea is to blow up speedboats, and that will please the boss? Is it all Rubio, as has been said? I mean, Rubio has acquired surprisingly enormous amount of power, a pretty unusual amount of power.
And I mean, Rubio is the most direct channel to like the neocons on the one hand and to the regime change in Latin America community, to put it in a somewhat euphemistic way. But I mean, you know, in Florida, you know, the Venezuelan exile community or the Venezuelan expat community, the people who would like to see, still would like to see the Cuba liberated from the communists. I mean, you know, like this is, I just saw a piece about this that like, you know, Cuba's lurking in the background of all of this. Like they're hoping if they take Maduro out that the Cuban government will fall because it won't be getting oil from Venezuela anymore, that sort of thing. That construct, which has been around for so long. I mean, at this point, you know, more recently in Venezuela when Chavez took power, but with Cuba, I mean, the architecture that's been decades. And he really is like the main, it does seem to be like the main conduit through which that stuff plays out in the administration. And like, as you say, he's got like a tremendous position here as the Secretary of State and still the acting National Security Advisor. Like he's monopolized a lot of access to Trump, I think. So I do put a lot of this on him. I mean, I think the focus on Latin America is part of it's something that makes sense to Trump on an instinctive level. Like this should be our sphere. Like this should be America's place to do what it wants. But in terms of the specifics of it and the way that this stuff has gone, I think Rubio has a huge role. And there was, of course, like, you know, Richard Grenell, who took time out of his busy schedule running the Kennedy Center to be their envoy to Maduro. And this is one of the things maybe we could talk about, too, is like Trump. Yes. Keep sending these envoys to just talk to guys, which I think is a somewhat redemptive aspect of his foreign policy in a sense. But you know, there was that report that like in the middle of a meeting, like he was meeting with Rubio and a bunch of other security guys, and he like called Grenell in the middle of the meeting. It was like, stop this shit. We're not talking to him anymore. And just turned, you know, on a dime to this solely military approach. So yeah, I mean, I think Rubio is definitely the main figure here at this point.
I mean, when you look at some of the other figure, it does really seem like Rubio's bag. And because some of the other big figures in the Trump global orbit, foreign policy orbit, people like Hegseth, Colby. And then of course, like Witkoff and Bark, like they're not focused so much on Latin America.
Right.
But there is a wing, and it does seem to have a lot more prominence in Trump 2 than Trump 1, the restraint, kind of the conservative restraint wing, the retrenchment wing, the anti-globalist, you know, America spread out all over the world wing. So, but they don't seem to be specifically involved in this, but they don't seem to be like, this doesn't seem to conflict with that vision, I guess.
I think, because it's closer and it's more direct and, you know, it doesn't necessarily trigger the same, you know, red lines, I guess, in that right wing, like really far right restraint community that you know looks askance at like you know, why are we sending weapons to Ukraine? Why are we supporting Israel through, you know, thick and thin? Like, why are we here? Why are we there? It doesn't seem to trigger them as much when it's happening in the Caribbean or Latin America.
Is there something like a MAGA blob that's developing in DC? I guess, and then would sort of Elbridge Colby and some of those people be a kind of counter MAGA blob or something? Or where's Hegseth on this? Or is he?
I think Hegseth's just happy to be there, man.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, let me have my like Deus Vult rally with the generals and like tell them they're all fat pigs and they need to do pushups. Yeah. And like, you know, then I'll crawl back into a bottle and you know, you can leave me alone for a while. Like, I don't think he cares. Yeah. Like, he's just there having a good time. I don't think he's got a big policy role, at least maybe a, maybe that's wishful thinking. I don't know. But he just strikes me as, you know, somebody who's along for the ride.
I was told by people who've, you know, been, I mean, you meet a lot of people, right? When you do this business, and people who kind of come from the restraint community that kind of vouched for Hegseth that no, he really has, like he does sort of believe in this vision, this restraint vision.
I know, a deep but thinker.
Like, he's sort of like he's aligned with them basically, and he's gonna help them and be their kind of, you know, their sponsor in a sense in the administration to try to give them a voice, and that did sort of happen.
He needs
and then
a sponsor,
they got creamed.
You know what
yes.
I'm saying?
But like, but I mean, it seems pretty clear that Hegseth wants to be where Hegseth is, and
vision, I just schmision, don't see him right? pushing on anything.
Yeah,
like, he's just rolling with the punches.
He didn't seem to back those people who got forced out by the sort of neocon attacks. So.
No, I mean he didn't stand up for any of those guys. He was like, I mean, I don't know where he was when we were bombing Iran, if he was on vacation or something, but I didn't see for that being a military action. Like, I didn't see the secretary of the pretend secretary of war anywhere while that was going on. So I don't know that he's really sticking his head up that much or just, you know, as opposed to just kind of bunkering down and being happy with what he's got. Colby's the interesting one to me. You mentioned him. Like, he's what I've seen so far is that he's like consistently eating shit basically from these guys. Like, he's
I'm sorry
getting,
to cut you off. We should tell people Elbridge Colby is the undersecretary of war. Now we have to say undersecretary of war.
You don't have to say it's not official Department of War. So you do not.
I like it. I like it's mask off, man. So, you know, so he would in theory be in charge of developing policy, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Right. And I mean, but like it's funny to me because he's been the subject of multiple big, not necessarily friendly profile stories, you know, over the past few months. And when was the last time the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy was the subject of like somebody's big expose in Politico or, you know, the Wall Street Journal or something? So, and I think it's people who don't like what he wants to do with respect to China policy mostly, because he's been the one who's sort of out in front of like Joe Biden's greatest accomplishment, AUKUS, and like we're reviewing this, we're not sure if we want to do it. And then, you know, when I say he's eating shit, like there's a big, you know, this becomes a big story and like gets, you know, featured in a bunch of places. And Elbridge Colby is prominently mentioned as the guy who's leading this review. And then a few months later, you get Rubio or somebody else who just tells the Australians like, yeah, we're going to still do this. Like, don't worry about it. And then, you know, what does that say about Colby's influence in the administration? Like, it doesn't seem to say very much. But yeah, I mean, I do think he's like the closest thing, it seems to me, to like a true believer that there is a Trump foreign policy vision or like a MAGA foreign policy vision that he's trying to implement. I just don't know that anybody, it seems like a lot of people pursuing their own agendas at this point. Which you could also have said about the Biden administration. It's just that their agendas were all aligned with one another in a more cohesive way, I think, than these guys.
What they said about Colby. So a friend of the show, Alex Zajcik, wrote an interesting, more, I guess you'd call it a balanced piece about Colby at a time when there were a lot of hit pieces planted in hit pieces. Favorite place, Politico, and so on Colby. His is a bit more sort of balanced. I think he wrote it for Drop Site. But it seemed that Colby was a real China hawk. But as it's turned out, Colby, as you said, and even Trump have turned out to be, as far as I can tell, at this moment, less hawkish on China than the Biden. Like, it seemed like the Biden administration sort of took Trump one, ramped it up to a new level, and then added a lot of really weird bluster to it, which seemed very counterproductive if you even by their own stand, you know, by the standards of what Biden people right. wanted to do. And the Trump people seem to be coming around to the idea that, okay, it turns out China's actually a lot tougher than we thought. Like, we can't bully them around the way we sort of thought we could. So we're going to give them their, we're basically going to
see Taiwan. They have our entire tech history, tech industry by the balls.
Like, yes.
Yeah. I mean, Dan, this is something that Danny talks about a lot, that eventually, you know, the U.S. defense of Taiwan is going to be shown to be on paper only. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I tend to agree with that. Like, when push comes to shove, the United States is probably not going to go to World War III with China over Taiwan. I do think that, you know, we're going to keep selling them weapons. They keep buying the really expensive ones that would be destroyed within 5 minutes of an actual Chinese invasion, instead of buying like the cheaper stuff that might actually allow them to put up a resistance, which is a whole nother discussion to have.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like there's been a realization. I look at this sort of in the same along the same lines as like the transition in Iran policy from Trump to Biden, which was like the easiest slam dunk. In the like the easiest thing on day one of Biden's presidency should have been, we're going back into the nuclear deal. Like, you know, forget everything that's happened over the last couple of years. We're back in. Let's rebuild it and go forward. And they didn't. You know, it was, again, like with China. They like looked at the belligerence of the Trump years and were like, we can pocket a lot of gains off of this. And of course, they were wrong, completely wrong.
Yeah.
And then Trump comes back and he's, you know, before we started bombing their nuclear sites, he was trying to engage diplomatically with Iran before the Israelis made it a fait accompli that we had to go to war with them. And I think the same thing with China. Like, he's taken a more nuanced approach than he had in his first term, and much more nuanced than the Biden people had. It's an interesting change. With China, I really think a lot of it is like, he's got all these tech people around him now, and like maybe Biden didn't. And the whole approach to the tech stuff under Biden was incoherent. It was like, we're going to prevent you guys from having these advanced chips. And the fact that you can like block us from getting access to the stuff we need to make the advanced chips, we don't care so much about that. We're just going to, you know, prevent you from getting these. And you're going to somehow panic and you know, go under. And of course, that didn't happen. And I think there's a realization on some level that, like, if you're going to get into a supply or like a trade war on that supply chain in particular, like, China can bottleneck the U.S., you know, 10 steps earlier in the process than the U.S. can get away with blocking things to China. So you can't win that fight. Like, that's just not a winnable trade war.
The other thing I thought was so incoherent was that, you know, Biden was all for the Ukraine war cause. I mean, they thought politically, this is how we're going to really unite a kind of disunited Western public behind, like, getting back to the status quo and the centrists and so on. But instead of trying hard to divide China from Russia, which is what normally you do, I would think, he really did everything to push China. Like, he went, he went above and beyond to show how belligerent he was towards China, that to prove he was more belligerent towards China in a really stupid way than Trump was. Like, remember, he came out and said, we will defend. And I mean, I grant it, he has dementia and so on, but I think this was like, you but tell he had a guy.
A few oopsies about, yeah, the, about that. Oopsies. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, it's we're like going to defend Taiwan.
Yeah. But I don't think they were. I think what it was somebody told them we need to have strategic ambiguity about it. And then that got translated into what's left of his brain as, I need to say, we're going to invade, you know, we're going to go to war, yeah, for Taiwan.
Exactly.
And like, they just did everything to push China much closer for existential reasons to Russia. And it seems like Trump is trying, the Trump regime and his people are maybe, I don't think they're necessarily trying to divide and conquer. They just sort of are looking for fights that they can pick and fights that they, that wouldn't be worth it picking. I don't
right.
know. Does that sound right?
Right. It does. It's interesting. You talk about like the U.S. pushing these countries together. Like I remember when Trump was elected in 2016. Like we did, I was editing Low Blog back then, which is now basically defunct. It got sort of absorbed by Quincy, but the site itself is
Jim
defunct.
Loeb?
Jim Loeb.
Ah,
yeah,
I remember him.
And he wrote a piece actually after reading Michael Flynn, because at the time, you know, Michael Flynn was going to be the national security advisor. He read one of his like depraved books and like wrote a review of it. And it was just this like unhinged, like there's this vast global conspiracy of nations that are all united, like they're all working together to screw the United States and destroy us, and we have to be aware of this.
That's
and
it's why just, Trump
it was like gibberish.
Okay. Yeah,
it was gibberish. But then, over three successive administrations, we have created the vast global conspiracy by sanctioning all these fucking people and, like, you know, getting into little spats with them and pushing them all together. Mm-hmm. So now you've got, you know, Russia and North Korea and China and Iran. Like, there is a sort of block. It's not, I don't think by choice, like, they haven't voluntarily opted into this. They're just kind of slammed together. Because they're all on the business end of sanctions and, you know, tariffs and whatever else. And, you know, they all have their own interests. They're not like actively necessarily working together. I mean, you know, China didn't race to Iran's aid during the 12-day war or anything like that. But they are more or less, you know, aligned on some level because we aligned them. Like we all pushed them into that.
And whereas Biden pushed China with Russia, you know, much closer to Russia, forced them closer to Russia and to support Russia. I mean, you could say, again, working within the Biden sphere, that one thing he did do somewhat successfully was keep India from being too close to Russia by basically turning a, very openly sort of turning a blind eye, as they like to say, to, you know, getting all that cheap Russian oil, and that kept them the team. And Trump's blowing that up now.
He's blowing that too. I mean, part of the rationale was they want that oil to come to market. Like they don't want, they never wanted to prevent Russian oil from coming to market, because that would have spiked gas prices. And, you know, that's the worst thing in the world for an American politician. So they never really wanted to stop the oil from flowing. And it was like, you know, India is a good conduit because they can buy it cheap and they need a lot of it. And, you know, they have a good relationship with Russia. Like, you know, historically they have a pretty close relationship. And so it was, I think, you know, not even turning a blind eye. I mean, I think they encouraged some of that.
Yes.
Because they didn't want the oil price, the oil market to collapse. They wanted to keep that moving. And that's, you know, that's why instead of just like sanctioning, although Trump is now sanctioning, you know, Lukoil and Rosneft. So who knows? But that's why they went through all these hoops of like, we're going to do a price cap that really isn't enforceable, but it's just sort of our sense that a Russian oil shouldn't cost as much as it does. It should be less. But never tried to do anything that would really just prevent the Russians from selling oil.
Yeah, because, I mean, that war has already hurt Germany and Europe enough as it is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that was the other thing, is you're going to lose more European countries if you, you know, if you push them too hard to stop buying Russian energy.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about Europe here and the Trump vision, such as it is. There was always this fear and hysteria that Trump was going to pull America out of NATO. That was part of this, you know, restraint slash budgets, you know, bring America back maybe to this hemisphere to terrorize only this hemisphere. Did anything actually happen? It seems there's been a little bit of movement there, but I don't know. How would you describe Trump's vision vis-a-vis NATO? And, you know, I guess we've already talked about the Ukraine-Russia war some.
I give the Europeans some credit for figuring out how to manage him. Mm. It seemed for a while like they were they still had no idea how to manage him. And you know, I've been not critical, but sort of, you know, making fun of these guys, I guess, because they went through Trump's first term and the whole narrative out of Europe was, you know, everything's changed. We can't rely on the United States anymore. This is such a shock to the system. And then like Biden got elected and you know, after 4 years of that, the response was, oh, okay, everything's fine now. Mm. Like we can just go back to yes. the way things were.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, oops, that didn't turn out to be right. But I do think they figured out how to like keep Gramps happy enough to maintain the relationship. And they've done it by appealing to like Trump's desire to sell weapons. So like turning the Ukraine, the structure of the Ukraine relationship away from aid and toward like, okay, we'll give the aid to Ukraine by buying all of your weapons and you can send them, you know, we can send them on. Like he seems pretty comfortable with that. You know, he still has these moments where he talks to Putin and then, you know, loses his bearings or whatever. I mean, I don't know what goes on there. But you know, by and large, like he doesn't seem as angry about, you know, the U.S. supporting Ukraine now that it's, you know, we're making money off of the deal.
Right.
And the other thing was, you know, making just kissing his ass. Just like, you know, he went over there for that leader summit and they did the whole rollout of like this, the 5% thing. Like, look, we're doing exactly what you want us to do. And you're the boss.
Daddy.
Like, you're Gladys Knight and we're the pips. You know, like you're in charge and we're all just falling. And Mark Rutte, this new Secretary General, he's not new anymore, I guess, but the Secretary General has just been like the supreme Trump ass kisser of all time. He's just been like all over it. And I think that was it. Yeah he's the MVA. He's exactly. I think that's it. Like he just wants these people to be subservient to him. Like he wants them to bend the knee and they're happy to do it. And, but to do it in a way that maybe isn't going to cost them that much. So like they rigged up this 5% thing so that, you know, if we build a bridge, we can claim that there's some national security value to that and it can be part of the 5%. And by the way, like none of us have to be at 5% until like 2035 when Donald Trump will theoretically no longer be president, possibly no longer, you know, shuffling this mortal coil. Yes. So we don't really have to be
cryogenically frozen, I think.
Yeah, right. You can unthaw him just to bitch these people out. But like, you know, and even leaving aside the realm of policy, the theater of it, like do you remember when, you know, after he had, maybe it was the Alaska summit with Putin and there was this panicked surge that went through everybody in Europe and Zelensky, you know, flew off to the White House and all these European leaders joined him and they set up this photo op with Trump at the desk, at the Resolute desk, just like everybody else gathered around him, like they'd all been called into the guidance counselor's office or the principal's office and he was lecturing them. Like I'm sure he loves that shit.
Absolutely.
Like he loves to have it look like these guys are all at school and he's the, you know, he's teaching them or lecturing them. And so even their willingness to do that and just eat shit at a photograph, I think pays dividends in terms of Trump being, you know, now not happy necessarily, but just sort of, you know, he's more comfortable with them now than I think he felt in his first term when there was some pushback.
Yeah. Yeah. My own sense is that coming in, Trump really didn't like Zelensky in Ukraine because of Russiagate and the impeachments, and that because it was the Democrats' globalist cause, it was against, you know, he was against it. and liking Putin tweaked the right people. And he really expected Putin to make him look good with a peace deal that he could then shove in Biden's face, that I brought peace. And then when Putin didn't give him that because Russia hasn't achieved its main aims, which is really to totally Finlandize Ukraine, when he didn't get that, he started to not like Putin anymore. So he's kind of, he's kind of bouncing back and forth between two sides he really just doesn't like and doesn't know how to unload that whole problem, except to say, if I was in office, it never would have happened in the first place.
But the Putin thing seems almost plaintive to me. Like he's like, look, man, I'm trying to give you what you want and you won't give me anything in return. Like, you know, and it just frustrates him. Right.
Yes.
I think that's, I think that's a lot of it. It's just in a lizard brain way. he feels like he's trying to play nice with the other, you know, schoolyard bully here, and he's not getting anything back, and just like,
gets
frustrated with it.
There's something oddly earnest and wounded about Trump's reaction to it. Like, I'm trying for you, man. This isn't fair. This isn't how it goes.
Like, you know, they were going to do that Budapest summit, and then, you know, they got some nasty gram from Sergey Lavrov. And Trump's going out to reporters like, I don't think there's any point for me to meet with Putin now. I don't, what would we talk about? It really is. It's just like, you know, very, very wounded kind of sentiment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you brought this up earlier, and I want to talk about this a little bit more. I'm sorry to be keeping you so long. Can you keep going for a bit? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Thanks. I wanted to talk with you about envoys. It seems that Trump has relied a lot more on envoys, at least so far in 2025. In first term Trump, he had, Rex Tillerman. He was the first Secretary of State.
That's so long ago.
I know, isn't it? Isn't
that crazy? Rex Tillerman, man, what a blast from the past.
See him on a game show. Can you remember this man?
God.
Yeah.
He didn't last very long,
He
right?
didn't
I mean,
last
he was like
long.
A couple of months in. And
yeah.
Like,
I think
don't
he
need
thought
this.
That I was... he was, I think he thought that they were going to kind of, stop playing, you know, global policeman and get like serious and adult like kind of a George Bush one, and it turned out nope, it's all about Trump. Yeah,
sorry.
And so he left, and so pretty much looking back now, I was just thinking about it. Trump one foreign policy was almost exclusively farmed out to Pompeo, who was the CIA chief, and then moved from CIA to.
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, which is really interesting looking back because this time around it's Rubio, who's kind of a Pompeo-like, I guess, in a way.
I mean, they seem to have some affinities, certainly.
Some affinities, yeah. But then it's really envoys. Witkoff, of course, Barak, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Barak. And Bulos, like, so who are these, like, what does the reliance on these guys say about Trump's vision and his foreign policy and how it sort of, is there some consistency with everything we've been talking about here?
It's interesting because it's a very, you know, it strikes me as like a very medieval, like I'm sending my cousin out to talk to somebody, it's just a very like, personalized conception of the executive that like you have these guys who are your real estate buddies or in Bulos's case, like, you know, an in-law, and these are the people that you really trust to carry your message. Like you don't trust the professional diplomats. You don't trust even the guys like Rubio, who I don't think is really the person that Trump goes to when he said, you know, wants to send somebody to talk to another foreign leader and give them a message. Like Rubio, I think is still too independent for that as obsequious as he seems to be most of the time. But like when he really just wants to convey something directly, it's Witkoff or, you know, one of these other guys. And they really are like, they're just his rich buddies, like Mar-a-Lago buddies, who get appointed to these jobs. It's interesting. Like, this is one of the most interesting features of his foreign policy to me in the personnel department, because you can really see the upside and the downside of having these guys who have no background in any of this shit. So they're not, on the plus side, like, they're not bound by any of the bullshit dogmatic strictures of U.S. foreign policy. Like, they don't, like, Steve Witkoff goes over to, you know, Israel and isn't really steeped in the idea that, you know, he should just genuflect to Benjamin Netanyahu and do whatever he wants. Rubio is. And when Rubio goes over there, it's a much different tone.
Yeah, he's making out with the Western Wall.
I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, but Witkoff's there, like, you know, I'm here to represent the United States. I'm not, you know, I don't have to kowtow to these people. He does seem to carry himself that way. And you know, there's some of that in some of the in Bulos as well. You know, that's a less critical region, I think, a less kind of less controversy there maybe than the Middle East. Certainly, Barak is interesting. I don't have a great read on him yet. He's sort of the go-to guy for the everything north of Israel. He's the ambassador to Turkey, but he's handling Syria, he's handling Lebanon, like, he's doing all this stuff. But yeah, like, so they're not, these guys, they seem to be somewhat independent of all the, like, restrictions that somebody who's steeped in the U.S. foreign policy milieu would have. But at the same time, like, they don't know anything. So, like, when Witkoff goes to Russia and Vladimir Putin gives him a lecture about how Ukraine's not a real country, like, you know, Walt Disney invented it with claymation in 1925 or whatever. Like, he's taking notes. He's not just like, okay, Grandpa, thanks. That's nice. Yeah. But he's like listening to this and paying attention to it.
Wow, so you get, I didn't,
like,
know
the upside. Yeah, like, wow, that's a real revelation to me. Thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you get sort of the upside and the downside, I guess, of having these people who are outside of that world play such a big role in it.
I mean, is it because, I guess the question would be this: why was Trump able to get a ceasefire, as ugly and dirty and awful as it is, in Gaza, that is still holding and seems likely to hold in a gruesome Israel-friendly way for a while, but still better than the full-on genocide.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I saw today, there's a piece at the Wall Street Journal about how they're actually standing down reservists, which seems like a big step to take. Like, it would, you would have to call those guys back up if you were going to resume resume full-scale war. So that really is the first time I've seen anything since the ceasefire came into effect where I was like, okay, this may be actually going to stick.
Right. But why do you think Trump was able to do that and Biden wasn't, I guess, aside from the fact that Biden didn't want to? I mean, maybe it's just as simple
as
that.
I think that's it. Like, okay. Trump didn't want to either for months until, I think maybe this is like buying the kayfabe to some degree, but I do think that strike on Qatar, like, really pushed it too far. Like, it was really like, okay, that's, You can't just, like, fucking bomb Qatar. And I, you know, everything that I've seen suggests that the U.S. was caught off guard to some extent by that. I mean, how early they knew, or, you know, when they were able to inform the Qataris or whatever, like, is still up in the air, I guess. But I think the response to it suggests, like, you know, the fact that he, like, you know, Netanyahu came to the White House and he made him get on the phone with the Emir of Qatar and, like, read that apology to him. Like, that's really something. Like, gee whiz. Is, and they took a picture of it with, like, the phone in Trump's lap, and Netanyahu sort of sheepishly on the phone. Like, I'm really sorry we did this. Like, that's some real theater if they're just putting that on for show. So I don't know. And the ceasefire came not that long after that. So I tend to still feel like that was the point where Trump said, okay, I mean, we can't keep doing this. And, you know, he is a, like, gut level type of person. So, you know, he's tired of it. He's bored. Like, you're not doing what I want you to do. Like, this is boring. I'm sick of reading about it all the time, or sick of seeing it on my favorite TV shows. And, you know, maybe he caught a couple of images of, you know, kids with their limbs blown off or something that freaked him out. And, you know, that contributed to it. I don't know.
Do you think the MAGA pushback, I really do give a lot of weight to the Cutter thing. I'm speaking about his gut sense, and he has had some good guts. Do you think the MAGA, like MAGA kind of exploded in anger?
Some of his shows.
Simultaneously, with the bombing of Iran, which just made him look like Netanyahu's bitch.
Right.
And right at the same time saying that Epstein was a hoax.
I don't know, what do you think? It's probably all of that stuff. You're right. I mean, I've tried to avoid the Epstein thing. Like, I just don't have the I don't have the mental capacity to deal with it. But I know the basic crowd stuff, but that's what I mean. Like, just to follow like all the like talk shows or whatever. Like, I can't do it, man. But yeah, I mean, I think there, you're right. There was this whole sort of pushback to what was going on. And again, like, these are his favorite shows, and he is responsive. We know he's responsive to like what he sees on Fox News when he's watching in the evening, or like, you know, what he hears to some of these people. So I think, yeah, that was probably part of it too. It just all seemed to come to a head at the same time. And then, you know, I think it was a matter of exerting the pressure that U.S. presidents always have at their disposal to exert on Israel that they never choose to exert. He did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just said, this is enough. Stop.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they designed a ceasefire that, as you said, is very much favors Israel. It lets them keep firing, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're killing a few people every day. But, you know, that has taken the worst of it, the most intense parts of it. They're still not, you know, providing aid at the level they're supposed to. But, you know, has at least calmed it down substantially.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you about here is the latest war threat that Trump has now woken up and decided to take on.
We're going to Nigeria, boys.
Yes, we're going. We're going to Nigeria, me boys.
Okay,
what was that? Yeah. You know, somebody pointed out to me who was asking about this, who actually worked in, it's an old friend of mine who worked in some presidential campaigns in Nigeria. So he kind of knows the area a little better. And he's asking, like, where do these numbers even come from about, you know, supposedly a genocide of Christians and the numbers of attacks and so on. And he said, you know, I'm looking around at this to see where this genocide talk comes from. And he sends me this clip of Bill Maher, Trump's dinner friend, saying, why are we talking about genocide?
Yeah,
this is a real genocide. Why does nobody care? It's always that you look around
the world. Nigeria expert Bill Maher.
Yes.
Scholar and thinker.
yeah,
talked about it a couple of months ago on Real Time.
Yeah.
This is, I appreciate this because I can plug a piece that I published at Foreign Exchanges. Alex Thurston, who's one of my regular contributors and is a West Africa expert, wrote about this. He actually wrote this piece for me a couple of weeks ago because I'm so slow at editing stuff. I didn't get to it until Trump made this announcement like we're gonna invade Nigeria. Yeah. So it made it much more timely. I was like, well, okay, that's good. But yeah, it's this is a long-standing thing on the Christian right in the US to push this idea that there's a genocide against Christians in Nigeria. And not just Nigeria. I mean, they turned, you know, Islamic State, that when Islamic State was rampaging in Iraq and Syria, they turned that into a genocide against Christians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's on some level, on a policy level, it's about defining, you know, there's all these tools now that the federal government has to designate countries as failing religious freedom tests.
Mm.
And that can bring, you know, sanctions or, you know, unwanted attention. And this has been around, I think the two biggest ones have been around since the Clinton administration.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, the ones that everybody plays around with now, there's the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and there's an Office of Religious Freedom in the State Department. And the latter one is the one that can actually do things with legal effect to designate countries as, you know, failing whatever litmus test there is. And for the Christian right in the U.S., like this is... They desperately want to claim these offices so that they can define religious freedom as only applying to Christians or maybe Christians and Jews, but definitely not Muslims.
Right.
So, like, this is a jockeying for position on some level. But in Nigeria, it's been for years now, and they actually succeeded in Trump's first term of getting him to designate Nigeria as a country of particular concern. That's the term that's used on religious freedom, and he did it. He's doing it again now. That was sort of late in his first term that he actually did it, but you know, it was a big victory for those guys. And then Biden, stupid Joe Biden, no, he rescinded it. What this rests on is two basically lies. I mean, basically lies. Nigeria has a ton of security challenges internally. It's got a huge jihadist problem. It's got banditry, you know, organized banditry all over the northern part of the country. It's got separatist movements in the south. And there's also... the traditional like farmer herder conflict across this kind of central belt of Nigeria with, you know, climate change and you know, overuse sort of, you know, cutting into resources that both of these communities need, and they're kind of squashed together more and more trying to coexist and fighting, usually, you know, often violently over control of those resources. And what this claim is, the genocide claim, rests on the idea that the jihadist violence, which is mostly Boko Haram and Islamic State West Africa Province, the two big ones. There are smaller groups that operate in other parts of the country, but both of them operate in the Northeast. That they are engaged in anti-Christian violence, which is flat, it is ridiculous, really. I mean, they use anti-Christian rhetoric because Nigeria is still, it's not quite, it used to be almost 50-50 divided, the population between Muslims and Christians. Muslims are a majority now, I think, but it's still very, very close. So they get a lot of play out of like anti-Christian rhetoric, but they operate in the northern part of the country, which is majority Muslim. Like they kill way more Muslims than Christians. There's no question. Even Massad Boulos, you know, Trump's Africa guy, Africa envoy, has said this. Like the violence in Nigeria, the jihadist violence falls much more, the burden of that falls much more on the Muslim communities than the Christian communities. And then the second thing they do is they paint this farmer herder violence as anti-Christian genocide, because the farming communities tend to be Christian. Mm. The herding communities tend to be Muslim. They're mostly Fulani ethnically and Muslim. And that's just a fundamental, like, willful misreading of that conflict. It's a resource war between, you know, two communities that the religious aspect of it is incidental. And the Christian farming communities, you know, maybe if there's an imbalance, there's slightly more herder on farmer violence, but it's not by much. Like the farming community, the farmers, you know, farming militias, drawn from those communities, attack Fulani herders all the time. Mm-hmm. Like it's very much back and forth. It's not anything that you would call a genocide. So they take these two aspects of the violence and they spin it as, you know, look at this, you know, horrible anti-Christian genocide. And then I mean, you know, Trump doesn't know. I mean, does Trump even know where Nigeria is? Probably not. So, you know, they get, and but does Bill Maher know where Nigeria is? I mean, he might be able to point to it on a map. I don't know. But yeah, they get, you know, they get a lot of play with these things. And Maher doesn't care. As you said, Maher, you know, he's trying to deflect from Gaza. I mean, he's trying to point to something else that he also doesn't give a shit about. and say, "Well, why aren't you complaining about this genocide?" And it just happens that he, you know, picked one that isn't a real genocide.
Yeah.
But you know, it sounds bad, so you can make hay out of it.
Well, there's also the small point that the U.S. isn't arming Boko Haram and Islamic State to murder
that
Christians.
Doesn't stop these guys. Although, like, why aren't you protesting Sudan? People seem to elide the fact that, like, we're not really. We're not really involved in the same way. So maybe when you protest what your government is doing because you're trying to affect change, you stick to the things that your government is actually doing. I don't know. Yeah.
There aren't people with SAF or RSF sweatshirts on and you know,
flags
in their offices.
Donning the uniforms of the Sudanese armed forces like in the halls of Congress,
I think this has been a great conversation, by the way. I really appreciate you coming on.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I just have one last question. Is there a line you can draw from Dick Cheney to Trump and Trump MAGA? Because the Trump people and MAGA and the crowd around him definitely like to believe, want to believe, and do believe that Trump represents a complete break from Cheneyism. And you know, probably in some ways,
Dick
Cheney
crawled so that Donald Trump could run or oozed. I don't know. He oozed so that Donald Trump could run.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, Dick Cheney's entire project, aside from, you know, causing a lot of death and destruction around the world during the W. Bush administration, was about creating the unitary presidency. I mean, we were already on the road to that anyway, but it was about, like, you know, injecting that process with, you know, like some steroid concoction or caffeine supplement and just, like, boosting it into overdrive. Mm-hmm. The idea that the president, within whatever sphere you want to define, and in this case it's national security, but it's really like everything, that the presidency is an elected kingship. Like, there's no check. Mm-hmm. The courts can't stop him. The Congress is irrelevant. As long as it can be spun in a way that's like, we have to do this for national security reasons, the president has unlimited authority. And I mean, that's all over this stuff. Like, that's all over what Trump is doing. Like, we would not be, it would be harder. I'm not going to say we wouldn't be, because again, like, we've been on this train since the 1940s, really, if not before. But without Cheney, without the things that Cheney did to create legally, I mean, he had all these, you know, had all the lawyers on his staff. He had John Yoo in the White House counsel, all these guys working on this constantly, writing memos like the president is, you know, can, you know, shove a kid's testicles in a drawer or whatever Yoo's thing was. Like, it doesn't matter. Everything is fair game. And like the boat thing to me is the most obvious, where you can just be like, oh, look, it's a speedboat, blow it up and, you know, come back later and say, yeah, you know, we wrote a memo. It's like a drug thing, whatever. Fuck you. Like, you would have a harder time with that, I think. You'd be inventing it whole cloth to be doing it now, or almost whole cloth. But the way things are now, they can just point to the precedents that were set throughout the you know, post 2001 war on terror, as justification for the things that they're doing. So I think definitely there's a connection. We did a little, like, special Dick Cheney eulogy on our show.
Good.
After he died, and like the other thing that it occurred to me
a lot of hankies,
while we were in the middle of recording that was, you know, Trump's old joke about how he could pull out a gun and shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not pay any price for it. Dick Cheney shot a guy. He shot a guy in the face.
Yes.
And he didn't pay any price. That guy apologized to him for putting his face in front of his shotgun. Like, that's, I mean, that is a microcosm, but that's it. Like, they are so tightly bound to me in terms of, like, where we came from and how we got here.
Yeah, I mean, Trump is sort of Cheney plus Don Rickles times Roy Cohn, I guess. But
yeah,
Cheney,
it's like if you cross Cheney and the Kardashians or something, you get you know, something that looks like the Trump administration.
Yeah. All right, great. Well, that's a good, happy way to end this conversation. So thank you so much, Derek Davison of American Prestige, for coming on and talking about the world according to Trump.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me. This was great.
Really appreciate it. All right, everyone, thanks again. By the way, I want to remind everyone again to get, well, subscribers will be getting the new War Nerd Civil War book, They Should Have Been Hanged, War Nerd U.S. Civil War essays. But you can also buy it and support John while he's in the hospital still. He'll be out soon. And as Anibale said, this is an order. You must go out, get the book, support the book, and review it and help John recover. Anyway, thank you again to Derek. Thank you, Brendan. Thank you, everyone. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.